KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me on the show today. I'm excited to have on Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine and Wired.com, author of the new book, Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the Billion-Dollar Cybercrime Underground. Hacking and hackers is a topic that we have discussed on the show almost from its inception, from having Jennifer Granick on as a former director of the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, to more recently people like Derek Baumbauer from Brooklyn and Oliver Day at Harvard and Paul Ohm at Chicago, at Colorado, and others talking about hacker culture and the use of the word hacker. Annalee Newitz was on discussing hackers as well. And now I'm excited to have on Kevin discussing this amazing story involving, as the subtitle of the book suggests, how one hacker took over the billion-dollar cybercrime underground. Kevin is a journalist at Wired. He's been with Wired for over 10 years. Previously, he had his own career of sorts in the hacking world, which I'll allow Kevin to talk about to the extent that he wants to in a bit more detail. But his background and knowledge of this community is of immeasurable value to anyone trying to learn more about what goes on in this world, which often operates behind the shadows, but as Kevin's book suggests, is much more mainstream and much more known to mainstream entities, like, for example, the focus of this book, which is the credit card industry and the banking industry more broadly. In Kingpin, Kevin traces the story of a hacker, and I'll just use that word for now, and we'll fine-grain it later, Max Butler, who went from doing relatively innocent things with computers to being an integral part of a network that looked to take credit card information and use it for nefarious purposes. Part of our discussion, of course, will be the fact that, as Kevin points out in the book, the technology that is used, the technology that, in fact, the hackers latch onto, is a relatively old technology. That stripe, that magnetic stripe on the back of any credit card or various other cards that you have, is a relatively old technology as compared to what we have today. And indeed, that is the technology that that Max Butler and others were able to use to gain information that then was shared well outside where anyone would reasonably like. Kevin's focus in the book is this world of hackers, and the world ultimately that we're thinking about is the world of hacking, but more specifically we're going to look at the life and the experience of Max Butler. By way of background, Kevin is a senior editor at Wired.com and a contributor to Wire magazine. He also runs the Threat Level blog through Wired, which is a terrific blog that I read regularly. Kevin is also, by way of disclosure, the husband of Lauren Gelman, who was one of my bosses when I was a resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society. And so I've known Kevin for a few years. But I'm very excited to have Kevin on the show today. Kevin, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me, David.
Kevin, let's start off with a question that I ask most of my authors, which is the genesis of this project. Why did you decide you wanted to write this book?
You know, I've been reporting on the computer underground for a long time, and what I've seen over the last 10 years really is the transformation of computer hacking from something that was done recreationally by amateurs to something that's done professionally and for profit. And we've seen the underground get very organized over the years. And I've wanted to tell a story about it, and at the same time, there was this hacker, Max Butler, whose skirmishes with the law I've been reporting on. And in 2007, it all kind of got rolled up into one thing when Max was busted for playing a major role in the for-profit computer underground. He'd been leading kind of a secret life, so I took a great interest in that.
That secret life is something that I want to focus on in a moment because obviously it plays so heavily into what hackers are known for. But perhaps you could contextualize initially, before we even get into Max Butler, a bit more about your own experience. As I mentioned in the introduction, you do have broad and almost unique experience in this area. Perhaps you could talk about that a little bit and how your own knowledge and experience with hacking informed not only only the writing, but the research associated with this book.
Yeah, I was a computer hacker in the 80s, ending in 1991 when I was arrested. And my thing was the telephone company. Like a lot of hackers of that era, I was targeting telephone company systems and switches and mostly just playing around and experimenting. What wound up getting me in the most trouble was I used my access to cheat at radio station phone-in contests. So I won a Porsche, and I won some trips to Hawaii and a sizable amount of cash that way. When I got out of jail for that offense, I eventually gravitated into journalism, which is what I've been doing for the past 13 years now.
Was that switch of careers one that was natural for you? In other words, I mean, it certainly makes sense that you would go to an entity like Wired, arguably certainly the leading technology news resource, not only in the U.S., but in the world. Did you find
it to be... If not the universe.
If not the universe, right, exactly. And that being the case, is that something that was a relatively easy transition? In other words, I'm curious how you migrated to journalism. As your focus.
I've always enjoyed writing. That goes way back to like junior high, if not before. And I was, of course, a big book geek. What it comes down to, I think, is there are contributing impulses to hacking. And a lot of it is technical, the technical challenge of it, and the thrill. But there's also curiosity and the enjoying the freedom of looking into things, investigating things, and getting to the bottom of them, finding out how things work. Journalism to me was kind of a natural path to take, where I could legally act on at least one of the impulses that drove me to my life of crime previously. I did not, in fact, start off at Wired. I started off as a freelancer and writing for various publications. And then I was the editor at a computer security publication called securityfocus.com. And I worked there for about 5 years.
The world that you describe, the one that we're going to spend a lot of time on here, is one that is obscured to most people, and not just to people who are not hackers, but indeed is unknown beyond movies, even the people that focus on technology. The research process associated with putting a book like this together has to be a fascinating one, and I'm curious to ask you a couple questions there. The first is what you knew of Max Butler, if you did, before you began covering him for as a journalist, but also writing this book.
I first encountered Max back in 2000 while I was at Security Focus. He was a very well-known white hat hacker at the time, meaning he was a respected computer security researcher. He did consulting work. You would pay him $100 an hour, and he would hack your network for you and then tell you how he did it. And he also contributed a lot to the computer security community. In the middle of that, it suddenly emerged in the form of a federal indictment that Max had been leading kind of a double life, and he had staged an attack on the Pentagon. What happened was there was a computer security vulnerability and a very popular piece of software called Bind that you could at the time find all over the internet. And he was concerned that people weren't taking aggressive enough action to patch that security hole. So he, on his own, as kind of a Robin Hood prank thing, wrote software that would go out and it cracked thousands of Pentagon computers through the security hole and then patched the security hole behind it. He got caught for that. The FBI tried to turn him into an informant. He resisted that, and so he was charged with the Pentagon hacking. And that's when I kind of stepped into the case and started covering it aggressively for Security Focus. It was right in our backyard, both because he was a security professional who was really well known in the computer security community, and because it was a great hacking story. So that's where I first encountered him. When he ultimately was sentenced to 18 months in prison for that. When he got out, he sent an email to a computer security jobs list saying, I've just been released from jail, I'm in a halfway house, and I need work. I'll work now for minimum wage. I'll take anything you could offer. So I watched that with interest, and then more or less lost track of him until he emerged again in 2007 as a ringleader in this massive computer underground.
You use the phrase white hat hacker, and you use that phrase throughout the book, as well as black hat and even gray hat. So for the uninitiated, can you define those terms? What do those mean?
They shift a bit, and the borders can be blurry. But basically, a white hat hacker is somebody who takes a hacker's skill and mindset and uses it legally to do research primarily. So a white hat hacker will find computer security vulnerabilities in software, and rather than exploit those vulnerabilities criminally, they'll either work with the vendor to get them patched, or they'll write up the vulnerability and circulate it within the computer security community so that there can be some remediation taken. So that generally advances the state of research into these vulnerabilities. You can also outside the security context, a white hat hacker can be somebody who uses their skills to write software. Encryption programs would be a classic example, or just solve problems in clever ways. A black hat at the extreme end of the spectrum is a criminal computer intruder who uses his talents to victimize people, and increasingly to turn a profit at it at the same time.
And then this concept of gray hat, where does that? I mean, aside from the color spectrum, what does that entail, or what does that imply?
Gray hat is anywhere in between.
Yeah, so it's a literal.
You could call somebody a gray hat. What Max did with the Pentagon, you could kind of call a gray hat hack. In that, it might have been harmless. In that, it went out and it fixed security holes. He was committing crimes by doing it. So you can't really call him a white hat, but it wasn't done maliciously. Now In actuality, it was more of a black hat attack because at the time that he fixed these security holes, his code also left back doors in all of the computers that it accessed. So that undermines the gray hat claim there. But classically, that's kind of what the term means. So it's something that isn't necessarily legal, but it also isn't necessarily malicious.
So in law school parlance, those are the interesting situations, the ones right. that are not quite clear one way or the other. We're chatting with Kevin Paulson of Wired.com, author of the book Kingpin, How One Hacker took over the $1 billion cybercrime underground on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Kevin, yeah, I mentioned in my introduction that not too long ago, Derek Baumbauer and Oliver Day were on discussing an article that they wrote called the Hacker's Aegis. But one of the concerns they have is with the word hacker or the name hacker. They don't like it. We don't have to spend our time talking about their article per se, but I'm curious to get your thoughts, if any, on the term or word hacker. Do you think it's a good term? Would you look for other phraseology? Does it matter? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's the word has become kind of diluted in its meaning. It's very broad now. And it depends a lot on the context as to what it actually means. What was their problem with the usage of the word?
They find that the word has connotations, particularly negative ones, that are not that color the policy analysis of or involving cybersecurity, and that therefore the word itself is an impediment to meaningful discussion of these kinds of issues that more go towards issues of cybersecurity and control rather than somewhat amorphous and celebrated idea of hacking.
So they take issue with cybersecurity threats being categorized as hacking.
And broadly that the word itself does not adequately, or the connotations of the word do not adequately encompass what people that are called hackers actually do.
Okay. Well, in my writing, I try to be more specific than using the word hacker, because there are so many different varieties of computer intruders now. So, you know, it'll be hacker in the headline, but then it could be something more specific, a profit-oriented computer intruder, a cyber extortionist, something like that, in the actual prose. Because, as you say, the word now has become almost meaningless because it's used in so many different contexts.
And it's awkward to use it, but it seems like, I mean, certainly the subtitle of your book uses the word, and so for our purposes, we'll do that here. There's an interesting, I think, top level issue, not just in technology but in intellectual property, about certain words having become synonymous or at least associated with viewpoints that again don't accurately reflect where the debates are. Phrases like copyleft, I think, have a similar problem in that area. But turning back to the idea of the hacker, and I'll use that broad word despite concerns about it, if we think about a skill set, and we'll get the personality in a moment, because I think this gets us a bit more deeply into the story that you tell in Kingpin. What skills, if you were to define a core set of skills, need to be held by a hacker more broadly, although we'll fine-grain it to types of hackers shortly?
You know, a hacker has programming skills to begin with. And a way of looking at things that allows them to solve problems and to circumvent obstacles. That's the basic requirements for being a hacker, I think, by almost any definition of the word.
And then beyond that, personality traits. I mean, certainly the story that you tell of Max Butler is one that you know, the idea of risk taking certainly comes to mind. But if you were to define an appropriate skill set for someone that wanted to enter the world of hacking, be it white or black hat, what would you say are the necessary skills or the necessary personality traits?
I think if you're a hacker, you know it. You're kind of born a hacker. It's not really it's not really something you enter into. You decide, I'm going to be a hacker next year when I get out of college. it's something you know early on, just in the way you interact with technology and the way you solve problems.
It's interesting you mention that, because as I think about my own experience, while you were doing things that certainly define the kind of hacking that it would be the subject of books like this, my minimal foray into hacking, and I'm not even sure if it's appropriately called that, and the statute of limitations pretty much has run on it, was my effort to get my hands on Commodore 64 games without having to pay for them. And we're going back to the mid and early 80s. And I think, literally what that meant is, could be nothing more than taking one floppy disk and loading it into the memory of my Commodore and then saving what was in the memory onto another floppy disk, hence hacking. And I'm curious to know whether that, you know, obviously unsophisticated basic idea, which was done only for the purpose of being able to play games, would meet the modern definition of a hacker. In other words, is there any similarity today to kind of hacking and sophisticated criminal activity that you talk about in Kingpin to the simple activity of wanting to play Boulder Dash on a floppy disk that I didn't have to buy?
What's happening today is vastly more sophisticated than what you were doing with your Commodore 64, or what I was doing with my TRS-80 at probably about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It it you you could, if you were to start with you know, your Commodore 64 hack and let it germinate and grow to massive proportions, you might find that it starts the same way, that it has the same kind of kernel of finding ways to subvert obstacles, that element of sneakiness. But it's just so huge now, and at such a sophisticated level that it's hard to see that at the root of it.
You know, it's an interesting response, because I was thinking about this question in the context of how you begin the story in Kingpin, and I'll ask you to talk about it, because Max Butler obviously does not start as the person who's running an international criminal network to take credit card information. He starts off at a relatively small level, and perhaps that idea of germination is the key difference between a Max Butler and the mere copying of software, putting aside whether, you know, I have the personality traits to engage in this, and I suspect I'm self-aware enough to say that I do not, be that good or bad. I don't think that's my personality, but I'm curious, because Butler starts off relatively small scale. How did Butler begin to enter this world of hacking?
He grew up in Idaho, a small town in Idaho. And he began with kind of the usual stuff in the late 80s of hacking the phone company to get free phone calls. When he went to college, he started hacking the university system. So he was doing the kind of the bedroom hacking, the recreational hacking that you see in Matthew Broderick do of War Games, That's where he got his start. Then around in the mid 90s, he moved into the serious work of computer security, and that's when he kind of came into his own as a prominent white hat hacker. But he still had the same mindset that he had had in Idaho. He still had some impishness to him. He still enjoyed experimenting and crossing boundaries, and that's what led him to this Pentagon hack.
So that gap there between going from getting free phone calls, which admittedly certainly is bigger scale than copying software. However, the same general principle applies: trying to get something for free that you otherwise have to pay for. It is obviously an enormous jump from there to the Pentagon. What do you attribute this change? What happened to Max Butler? What experiences did he have that caused him to, rather than go the direction I did, which is kind of say, I'm done with games for now and moving on to other things that had nothing to do with hacking or even computers for that matter. Whereas Max Butler says, now there's more to do. Let me try messing with the Pentagon.
Well, you walked away from computers. You didn't stay in that area. You didn't feed the compulsion that led you to pirate Commodore 64 games.
Right.
Max stayed in computers. Computers were his first love, he made his career there, and it was his passion and his hobby all rolled into one. The culture that he was a part of, hacking is part of that culture. He knew other hackers, and he knew computer security people. So it was more a matter of him just staying on this track that led him to this Pentagon hack. It's kind of a natural thing to do if you're coming from a certain place. He's a guy who specializes in fixing security holes. He's also a guy who doesn't always ask permission to do things that he thinks should be done. He's a guy who doesn't recognize boundaries of what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate. So that all conspired to lead him to this Pentagon hack. And that is what led him to everything else that happened in his life.
We're chatting with Kevin Paulson of Wired.com, author of the book Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 Billion Cybercrime Underground, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. And I suspect Kevin and perhaps some of the people he knows could come up with other ways you can make a donation to KZSU. But those are the two authorized ways to give us money. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. Yeah, one of the aspects that you mentioned in the story of Max Butler that leads us to this $1 billion cybercrime underground that we're going to talk about shortly is the fact that he went in and out of prison. How many times did Butler ultimately go to prison before he engaged on this last boldest criminal enterprise? And what do you suspect that experience did to him?
Prison played a big role in the choices that he made, as well as resulting from them. He first went to prison when he was 19 years old. This was in Idaho. He was a very he lacked self-control at that point in his life, and his first serious relationship with a girl ended with her breaking up with him and him taking it very badly, and he wound up threatening her and assaulting her. The details of the assault are kind of in dispute, but what isn't in dispute is that he put his hands around her throat while threatening to kill her. And she later testified that at one point he squeezed hard enough to cut off her breathing momentarily. So he went. He actually went to trial on that and lost, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. That set him off basically on the wrong footing for the rest of his life, because while all of his friends were going to college and getting degrees and pursuing their careers afterwards, he was in an Idaho jail for what amounted to 4 years before he was paroled.
Go on.
When he got out, that's when he reinvented himself as Max Vision, the white hat hacker, and he moved to the Bay Area and started hanging out with some of his friends from Idaho. But he still kept one foot in this whole hacking underground. Even as he was working as a computer security professional, then he went to prison for the Pentagon hack, and he felt like he had been he was being abused. He felt that he didn't deserve to go to prison for that because it was well intentioned intrusion. Then when he got out, he wasn't able to get a job. Because he was now a convicted hacker in a very high-profile case, and that's when he wound up hooking up with one of the contacts that he'd made in prison, a more serious career white-collar criminal, a profit-oriented criminal, and embarked on his crime spree. He basically decided at that point that he was going to give up on being a law-abiding citizen. And give up on, at least for the moment, on working legitimately in computer security, and just become a criminal. And that's what he did.
Yeah, you mentioned something interesting there, which is another topic I wanted to explore a little bit, which is this community itself. And you know today in 2011, it's you know fairly well known, certainly not too debatable, and there's not a lot to say about it in its core, which is that communities are able to form through social media and blogs and everywhere else on the internet in order to meet like-minded people. But of course, when Max Butler and later Max Vision, same person, is engaging in these activities, he doesn't have the same technologies, or certainly the same technologies in terms of ease of access, to maintain this these communities. And yet, even while he's going in and out of prison, he maintains connections with the hacker, with a hacker community. I'm curious initially to ask you how tight-knit this community of hackers is it a monolith? Do white hat and black hat hackers have contact with each other? I'm sure like any group, there are demographic differences, but I'm curious at the top level initially, how tight knit is the world of Max Butler and hackers?
Well, back in the day, it was very tight knit. It was international. And everybody knew everybody else, and there was a lot of the barrier between white hat and black hat was permeable. So you would see black hat hackers would go legit. They would decide it was time to grow up and stop recreational intrusions, and they would form computer security companies, and they would hire some of their old hacking buddies, and a lot of these companies went on to become very successful, They would all gather together every year at conferences like the DEF CON conference in Las Vegas, and they would call each other by their handles, by their online nicknames, and then less commonly you would see somebody like Max go from being a white hat to a black hat. That was not the usual route to take. It was usually the opposite. But at the time, back then, we're talking now about the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, the stakes just weren't seen as that high. The white hats and the black hats were basically motivated by the same thing. They were in it because they loved it. It was a matter of pursuing their passion, and some of them did it illegally, and some of them found ways to do it legally. But they weren't really enemies. They were, depending on the circumstances, opponents. But they weren't enemies. And that whole culture has changed. That's something that is largely dying, because now the stakes are high, and the computer intrusions are being done for serious profit, and in some cases they're causing serious harm. So you don't see that kind of unofficial camaraderie between the black hats and the white hats as much anymore.
We're chatting with Kevin Poulsen of Wired.com, author of the book Kingpin, on KCCU-FM Stanford. And I should mention that we're recording this show on April 5th, and we are also interviewing Kevin via Skype from his office in San Francisco. So given the fact that there's now broadly a delineation between the white hat and the black hat hackers, I'm curious to know whether you think that Max Butler would be able to have the same kinds of success that he had and develop the career, as it were, that he did in today's environment. Have things changed such that it would be more or less difficult for a Max Vision to exist as he did in the United States?
Well, it depends at what point in your career you're talking about, or at what point in Max's career.
Well, it once he makes the turn to black hat hacking, is that something in particular? So I guess I'm talking about the Pentagon era, as it were. Is that something that you think he would have as easy a time doing today as he did then?
Everything has changed since then, so it's hard to say. Both the state of computer security has changed, and there just aren't many people doing what he did with that Pentagon hack, just acting purely for the joy of it, hacking recreationally, or just to pull a prank. Today you're most computer intruders are acting in the way that Max acted later when he got out of prison for the Pentagon hack, when he became a professional black hat.
So let's talk a little bit about those changes. What as you think about these issues and decide that things are radically different, are there some broad areas or broad issues that have radically changed such that you're hesitant to say that what would happen?
I'm sorry, can you ask that again?
Sure. So with regard to the factors that would go into an analysis to determine whether, in fact, Butler would make or have the success that he did, what has changed from the time that Butler, or what, from a broad perspective, what kind of changes are you thinking of that cause you to have some reticence in making the prediction?
A few things have changed. First, computer intrusion carries consequences now. So you can go to jail for years for doing a recreational hack, a hack that brings you nothing. At the same time, there are plenty of opportunities if you have a hacker mindset to work legitimately. So you could go to work for a computer security company, or you could start your own company, or you could get out of computer security and apply the same skills to inventing the next big thing on the internet. So there's a significant disincentive for breaking the law without a profit motive, and a significant incentive for staying legal and using your skills legally. So that, I think, is a big factor in these recreational intrusions becoming the minority. At the same time, there's an enormous amount of money to be made if you're going to break the law and you're willing to do it for profit. There's an enormous amount of money to be made. People are making millions and millions of dollars by hacking banks or by hacking or by doing the kind of credit card fraud that Max got into later. There's that draw, and that's really what's eliminated the amateurs from this.
Taking this issue from the perspective of the entities that are the victims of the hack, and put aside the government for the moment, because the focus of your book obviously is the private sector. In your interviews and discussions with people on the industry side of this issue, what happens behind the scenes inside a company when a hack like this happens? And it seems like on a regular basis, we read through blogs of email hacks and passwords being stolen. There was last week I got an email from TripAdvisor, I believe it was, telling me that perhaps my password had been somehow stolen. I've seen emails very recently saying that spammers have taken some server time this morning, for example, because someone gave out their password and their username to someone who was phishing. We see this activity, it seems, happening more prevalently, even though we think that the public has a better understanding of what to do and not to do. What is a company doing? And then we can talk about the banks in the context of the ultimate cybercrime that you discuss here. What, in your experience, what's the first reaction of businesses once this happens? And what are they thinking about at that point?
Well, it depends on the business and whether they've been hacked before and what kind of information was targeted. Their first reaction is obviously to try and find out what the intruder did and what they got away with, and then to bring in law enforcement. Something that used to not happen so often, but that does now. Because there are state laws now around the country that obligate you to warn customers of security breaches, they have to plan a PR strategy. So that's what happens. There was a time when a company that was hacked and who lost customer data, credit card numbers, social security numbers, that sort of thing, their first inclination would be to hush it up, at least in a lot of cases. And now, of course, because of California's SB 1386 and the follow-up laws in like 45, 46 states now, they don't have that option. So they tend to bring in the PR people relatively early and figure out how they're going to manage any fallout from the breach.
And this and the ultimate breach that you talk about here is this world of Carters. So again, for the uninitiated, what is this billion-dollar cybercrime underground that Max Butler or Max Vision ultimately took over?
This is probably the major change in computer crime that we've seen over the last decade, and it's an innovation that grew out of Eastern Europe around 2002. Some Eastern European hackers created a website called Carter Planet that was, you could think of it as kind of a cross between Facebook and eBay, but for cybercrime. It was a social networking site and online emporium for interacting with other criminals and buying and selling stolen data. Carter Planet was the first one, and then there was another one called Shadow Crew and a whole bunch more afterwards that would have thousands and thousands of users from all around the world, and they would vend stolen credit card numbers by the thousands. They would vend hacking software, various services, physical supplies. If you want to be a credit card forger, you could get all of the equipment that you need, and you can get the blank cards that you need and the magnetic stripe reprograms that you need from various vendors on these sites. And then match it with stolen data that you get from somebody else. So it made this previously very loose-knit underground into something organized and very efficient economically. That really kind of changed everything.
The world that Max Butler ultimately ran is one that which obviously put him in touch now with hardcore criminals that presumably had nothing to do or no knowledge of technology per se. Is there a non-technological side to the enterprise that Butler got involved in? If so, what does that entail? Is it literally the breaking and entry kind of theft that we know quite well today, but certainly predates the internet?
It gets physical kind of near the end of the food chain. So what Max did was when he decided to become a criminal, he didn't really know how to go about it. He knew that he had the skills to break into any system that he wanted to, but he didn't know how to make money off of that. That was kind of the missing link for him. So he had a partner, a former bank robber in Orange County, that bankrolled him, that got him started as a criminal, gave him computer gear, and he would check him into hotels to work from for weeks at a time. Max was expected to get results for that investment. He didn't know how to do it, so the first thing he did was he Googled. He did some Google searches to try and figure out how people were making money off of hacking. Huh. And that's when he discovered this underground that we've been talking about, the Carter Underground, websites like Carter Planet and Shadow Crew. The first step he took then was to basically hack these criminals. He staged a ruse that allowed him to crack dozens and dozens of these cyber crooks' machines and figure out exactly how they ran their various scams and then start stealing their stuff. So that's when his schemes got organized, and he was able to steal credit card data, magnetic stripe data, from other hackers and from people that were buying the data from other hackers. And then he gave that to his partner, the former bank robber in Orange County, who would start who would use them to make fake credit cards, counterfeit credit cards. The counterfeit credit cards would be used to buy up merchandise from department stores and boutiques, particularly high-end handbags, designer handbags, that would wind up on sale on eBay And that's how they cashed out the cards. That's how this whole process ended in them getting money. Max's partner made it's estimated about $1 million off of this.
So you know, looking at this story, which of course you know ultimately you know puts Max Butler in jail several times. You know, depending on one's perspective, having a book written about someone that goes from stealing or trying to get free telephone calls to you know theft and ultimately potentially ruining people's you know financial well-being is one that wouldn't garner much sympathy. I'm curious to know what your takeaway from the book should be. In other words, for the reader of your book, what do you want them to take from reading the story beyond a fascinating and insightful story of one's rise through the hacking world?
You know, it's what I strive to do with the book is to tell through Max the story of how the underground has evolved. I mean, Max lived something on the micro scale that unfolded on the macro scale of computer hacking. Transforming from this from something that was done for fun to something that's done for profit and is now very organized. So that's what the book is meant to illustrate. It's organized now. It's truly international, and the bad guys are as sophisticated as the good guys, which is also something that has changed since the days when a hacker was a 16-year-old operating from their bedroom. We're at the stage now where there are computer intruders who chose intrusion as a career right out of college, or who skipped college and went right into computer hacking as a career, largely in Eastern Europe, but their reach is global, and they're constantly perfecting new attacks. They're finding vulnerabilities in software and in systems before the good guys are. And they're getting very good at finding ways to make money off of it.
We're chatting with Kevin Paulson of Wired.com, author of the book Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the Billion-Dollar Cybercrime Underground, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Kevin, you know, one plausible read of this book, especially perhaps to someone who A, has a bent towards it, and B, may not know as much as, boy, this is a huge problem. We need more laws. We need stronger laws. We need more jails. So what would be your reaction as someone who at Wired has covered the Patriot Act, has covered issues involving the National Security Agency and AT&T? Certainly your blog discusses issues involving, you know, allegedly or arguably improper violations of privacy by the government. What would be your reaction as a journalist and an author to a member of Congress of that mindset holding up your book and saying Kingpin gives us another example of why the laws are not strong enough?
Well, presumably that member of Congress would have read the book and discovered that at the end Max got a 13-year prison term.
Right. But
other hackers, Albert Gonzalez, got a 20-year prison term.
But he was still able to do quite a bit of damage.
A hacker busted in Turkey who got a 30-year prison term in a Turkish prison. So I don't think stronger criminal laws anyway are any kind of answer, and I don't think anyone could seriously propose that at this point.
Well, the pushback on that here would be, I think, the argument. Yes, he ultimately got caught, but we need to do more to stop the Max Butlers, the Max Visions of the world from ever entering the enterprise. So we need to do more on the front end to deter this kind of activity, to prevent him from doing what he does, rather than being able to punish him after he's inflicted damage.
So you're talking about laws that would oblige companies to meet minimum security standards.
It could be that, or it could just be simply saying we're going to make the punishments more severe for the first time. You know, the classic Rockefeller in New York, the Rockefeller laws, three strikes and you're out, or any number of ideas that get towards in creating more laws, okay, creating more laws and stronger laws to prevent this kind of activity. What would be your reaction to that story? Or to that argument based upon your book?
Max started off as a recreational hacker because recreational hacking was what was done at the time that he was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have put him in prison for 15 years for his first offense for hacking the Pentagon for fun, and that probably would have either prevented or at least significantly delayed his entry into more serious crime. But that period in history is gone now. People aren't starting off as joyriding hackers now. They're going right into professional crime. So there's no point in trying to boost the penalties for earlier, mostly harmless crimes in the hopes of keeping the hackers from becoming more serious. They're going right into the serious stuff now. And with the possibility of making millions of dollars with a very low probability of being caught, changing the penalty from 20 years in prison to 30 years in prison isn't likely to make that big of a difference.
In the last couple of minutes that we have, I started asking the unfair questions, Kevin, and they're unfair because we don't have a lot of time. They're not unfair in terms of the questions themselves, but the timing. You have spent quite a bit of time. You've done some terrific work writing on WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and I'm curious in our last few minutes to get your thoughts on Assange as a hacker and what WikiLeaks has or has not done to impact the kinds of situations that you describe in Kingpin.
WikiLeaks is viewed. I learned this at the RSA conference, where I was on a panel about WikiLeaks, and I found that the audience was very hostile towards WikiLeaks. And it turns out that's because corporate America views WikiLeaks as the manifestation of the insider threat. The threat that they can't do anything about, which is that somebody inside their organization is going to betray them or betray the organization and leak secrets or information that'll hurt the company. That's really how WikiLeaks has affected the computer security world. There's no evidence really that WikiLeaks or the people for the most part that have provided material to WikiLeaks are cracking companies or governments from the outside. Certainly the biggest leaks have come from insiders. So it's not really a hacking question. It comes from this different realm of how do you protect your secrets from the inside. And that's a very different question. And in some ways, a lot of organizations, I think, overemphasize in their minds the risk of being hacked from the inside, because they, by and large, are still incredibly insecure from the outside, and that's really where the attacks are coming from, and where the threat is.
Kevin Paulson, author of the book Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 Billion Cybercrime Underground. Kevin, this is a book that, like I said, aside from the focus on hacking and the technological side of which you have, like I said, I think a unique set of knowledge to draw on in writing the book. I think it's also a broader sociological study of criminal activity and how one evolves in that direction. And I'm curious, as you think about next projects, if you want to talk about it, is there anything you're working on right now and either on the journalistic side if you can and want to talk about it, or even books that we can look forward to coming down the road?
I don't have any other book planned right now. I'm back at my desk at at Wired and the Threat Level blog, where we're devoting a lot of attention to WikiLeaks still. And the unfolding prosecution of Bradley Manning, the young Army intelligence officer who's alleged to be WikiLeaks' primary source for its U.S. leaks.
And I'll tell you, I think I can say this confidently, as I invite many guests on for repeat performances, that I invite you back on relatively soon, because that is an ongoing issue, and WikiLeaks is a topic that we could devote easily an entire hour to. And so I will invite you back for that conversation. But in the interim, thank you for joining us. Madison and Hearsay Culture and discussing your book, Kingpin. Greatly enjoyed it, and thank you for taking the time.
And thanks again for having me.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture, guests that will be further fleshing out some of these issues, but also discussing a variety of topics, both in IP as well as technology. As you have picked up on, the show now airs this quarter on Tuesdays from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. Pacific time, and that will be the time slot for this quarter for Hearsay Culture. You can look forward to, among others, Professor Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord, my colleagues at the Elon University School of Law, discussing online sales taxation. Professor Dan Soliv of George Washington University down the road, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants. Pamela Long, author of the book Obelisk, A History. Kevin Werbach on discussing his work, as well as Micah Sifri discussing WikiLeaks in his book WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency. Mario Biagli will be on discussing his work, and also Professor Mike Risch of Villanova University discussing the world of patent trolls. As always, you have a variety of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU Tuesdays, 4:30 to 5:30 p.m., or you can pick it up by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com or by going to Stanford CIS's iTunes page and by typing Center for Society in the iTunes search engine, or by subscribing to Stanford CIS's RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I am in the process of looking for guests for the summer quarter, and I welcome your comments and suggestions and feedback on guests as well as on previous shows. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.